Good morning. We're day four of our Sesshin. I had to look at my notes to remember that. Time does kind of a funny thing in Sesshin. So I'm continuing to talk about the Song of Zazen by Hakuin and the Practice of Rain by Tara Brach. I'm titling this talk, Nurtured in the Pure Land, We Return to the Suffering World as Bodhisattvas. So there's a line in the Song of Zazen. The pure land itself is near. So I thought we should know a little bit about pure land Buddhism, not just about the metaphor of a pure land, but about pure land Buddhism as a religion, as well as the pure land, the idea. So I'm just a little bit of educational moment here on the Pure Land for those who don't know. So Pure Land Buddhism originated in India, and it's, at least I wasn't able to find out a certain timeline of when that originated, but it appeared in China as early as 157 of the Common Era. So since Buddhism started about 500 years before the Common Era, we can know that probably at least, 500 years after the Buddha, maybe longer ago than that, is when this type of practice started. The doctrines and practices were disseminated by Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu, who are in our lineage. And today, it's one of the most widely practiced traditions of Buddhism in East Asia. So I think it's important that we know about it. Also today, 40% of Japanese Buddhists practice it. So in Japan, it's second only to Zen. So the Pure Land schools, and there are several schools, arose from the belief that humans were becoming incapable of the Dharma and needed help from another power. So, to me, it's like when I read that, it's like, oh yeah, I mean, we feel that way. and that other power in Pure Land Buddhism is Amitabha Buddha. So that's the so-called other power instead of self-power. And in Pure Land Buddhism, the practice is called Nembutsu, which is usually reciting Buddha's name, Amitabha Buddha, or bringing Buddha to mind. So maybe just not reciting out loud, but silently thinking of Buddha, trusting in Buddha. So that's the kind of a main practice philosophy of Pure Land Buddhism. And then the Pure Land itself is described as a blissful land. It's described in great detail in the Pure Land Sutras. There's three of them. Three main sutras. But these lands are also described in the Lotus Sutra and in the Flower Garland Sutra. So those are not technically Pure Land Sutras, but the lands that are described in those sutras certainly sync up well with the Pure Land descriptions. So basically, it's the land, the description of the land is there's much beauty, wonderful sounds, wonderful smells, beautiful sights. And sometimes it's described in very majestic, sort of regal ways with gold and lapis lazuli and, all these beautiful gemstones like that. But really it's for whatever the person, whatever is like would be wondrous and awe-inspiring for you would be what the Pure Land is. So the origin of the Pure Land is from a story in the Infinite Life Sutra. So that's one of the Pure Land Sutras. And it talks about a past life of Amitabha Buddha. So in a past life, he was a king who renounced his kingdom. So it sounds familiar, you know, that's also a Buddhist story of Shakyamuni Buddha. But anyway, he renounced his kingdom, and with the help from another Buddha, the Buddha Lokeshvajara, innumerable Buddha lands in the 10 directions were revealed to him. So not just on his own, but with the help of another Buddha, then this revelation was there, these innumerable Buddha lands in the 10 directions. And then after, it says, after meditating for 5 eons as a bodhisattva, he made a series of great vows to save all beings. And through that merit, he created the realm of ultimate bliss, which came to be known as the Pure Land. So it's interesting to me that the Pure Land was created through vows to save all beings. So it's sort of like, when I see like the things that Thich Nhat Hanh has created in his various, the various temples, where, you know, there's lotus ponds and there's, you know, there's a lot of beauty. And so it's like there's a merit, there's a vow to save all beings. And then the way that gets enacted sometimes is the creation of these beautiful lands. So in this story, it's sort of like though the Pure Land like miraculously happened as a result of Amitabha Buddha's vows. So some think of the Pure Land as an actual place where we would be reborn into after death. And others see it as more of a state of consciousness or the energy field of a Buddha. And it's also said that the Pure Land is equivalent to the attainment of enlightenment. So that's kind of what it's referring to. So some of the Pure Land teachings, one of the big teachings is visualization of such lands used in meditation. So, you know, instead of just sitting down and like whatever idle thoughts are coming into one's mind, one would direct one's thoughts to visualizing these beautiful lands. So kind of like, you know, to me that ties in with the nurturing part, like just being nurtured. And as we're here at Hokkyoji, that is, it's kind of a Pure Land here. I mean, it's a little warm today, but still, I look out the windows, there's a lot of green, the birds are singing. It's very, the sounds of the city. I'm okay. Myoshin just asked me if I was too warm, but I'm okay.
Okay.
So when we see the beauty all around us here, then in a way it's like we're visualizing a Pure Land. And you can do that even if you're in your home, even if looking at a picture or just closing your eyes and in your mind, or when you're on the Zoom call, when you hear the birds, you know, that's a way to taste that. Another important Pure Land teaching is that the idea that the Dharma brings its effects equally to all. So sometimes in other types of Buddhism, there's kind of this idea that you need, but not that you need to, but you see examples of saints or kings building temples to accumulate merit, like that there's, you know, people who have a lot of power or wealth are doing things to accumulate merit. And Pure Land Buddhism really emphasizes that, no, it's not like that. The Dharma is just available to everyone. So there was a lot of sort of the common people felt drawn to this type of Buddhism because of that teaching. That it's like, okay, you don't have to be a big important person. You can have the Dharma as well. It's right there. And then meditations in Pure Land Buddhism, in addition to the visualizations, like I said, there's a mindfulness of Amitabha Buddha, so reciting or silently thinking the name Amitabha Buddha. Also, I read something that there's something called the dual path of Chan and Pure Land cultivation. So Chan is the Chinese word for Zen. So the dual path of Chan and Pure Land cultivation, or it's also called the dual path of emptiness and existence. So very interesting. And that it's in that order. So like Zen or Chan is kind of emphasizing the emptiness, but then emphasizing the existence as the Pure Land. So like sometimes we actually need to imagine or cultivate some existence that's beautiful in order to strengthen our practice. And then there's another practice of meditation on Pure Land rebirth. And so this is a repetition of a Dharani, the mantra for birth in the Pure Land. And I didn't copy down the Dharani, but basically it's a chant, and that you just do it over and over again with having in your mind, I will be reborn in a Pure Land. And like, and that could either be thinking of it like an actual reincarnation, like after this physical body dies, or it could simply be birth into another state of mind. When this swirling state of mind dies, I enter into a Pure Land state of mind, this energy field of a Buddha. So that's just a little bit of background on Pure Land. And then going back to Hakuin. So anyway, Hakuin would have known about Pure Land Buddhism. I don't think he was saying that it was bad or something else. He was like pulling it in and including it in his teaching, in the Song of Zazen. So in the Zen teaching. So maybe in a way that's the dual path that he was also upholding. So he says the Pure Land itself is near. So this is, we don't need to go anywhere or do anything. So he's saying, and I'm sure he knew about Pure Land, but he's saying, okay, this Nembutsu or this practice of reciting Buddha's name or thinking of Buddha, it's not really necessary. It's not that it's bad, but that you don't need to do it because the Pure Land is already here. You don't have to call it into existence. It's right here. You only need to open your eyes. So for those of you who are familiar with the self-fulfillment samadhi by Dogen, you might be remembering that Dogen says in that poem, from the time you begin practicing with the teacher, the practices of incense burning, bowing, reciting Buddha's name, and reading sutras are not at all essential. Just sit, dropping off body and mind. And some translations even say the practices of incense burning, bowing, Nembutsu, and reading sutras are not at all essential. So Dogen, in a sense, was saying the same thing here that Hakuin is saying. These practices aren't essential. All you have to do is sit down and open your eyes and wake up. So I think this is where the nurturing step of rain really does come in, and it's helpful to us. When we're connected with that nurturing, then we're in the Pure Land. We're right there. And when we take this step, this nurturing step, the other power, so-called other power, is inside of us. So some Zen teachers and teaching kind of disparage Pure Land Buddhism for relying on this other power rather than, say, turning the light to shine within and waking up to one's own true self. So like emphasizing self-power. However, some Pure Land Buddhists criticize Zen for relying on self-power, which can easily be seen as a sort of ego power. Like, I'm doing it. I'm going to do it. There's a certain I'm going to do it, which is energy, which is effort, which is positive. But there's sometimes a way in which that gets a little bit twisted up with the I, emphasizing the I and the ego. So I'd say don't get tripped up on self-power or other power. It's really all the same power. I mean, if there's no separate self, it's really all the same power. And it just seems to me like sometimes it's helpful to emphasize self-power, like take that energy of, I need to have some agency, I need to take initiative, I need to move forward, I need to make this vow. And other times it's helpful to say, to surrender, like I can't do it. I can't do it on my own. I need some help. I need help from Amitabha Buddha or the Sangha or Jizo or whoever we want to cry out to. And in that cry, we're also, it's activating something in ourself as well. So anyway, that's the way I see it. So with that in mind, I want to share some ideas from Tara Brach on how to access the pure land through other power. So she calls this access to sources of nurturing. So I just want to read some ideas from her on that. And it really kind of seems like, in a way, it's a modern day visualization of the pure land. So she says this, when we can't access self-compassion, so when we find it hard to do that, it's time to find other sources of nurture. So in fact, when we can't just rely on self-power, then we need to turn to other power. She says we look outside ourselves for living experiences and exemplars of kindness that have particular meaning for us, and then call on them to nourish our hearts. She says, I call these resources anchors, resource anchors, because they build and stabilize the inner resources we are developing. So here are some resource anchors that students have shared with her. I visualize sitting with my grandmother at her kitchen table and put my hand on my heart and imagine her kindness pouring in. Or I carry around a photo of my son when he was 2 years old, sleeping with his head on our golden retriever. When I'm stuck, I look at it and feel the loving I've forgotten. So I don't think that you could see because you were facing sideways, but Angie was sitting earlier with her child, Abby, and their dog came and sat Zazen, like right between them. So it was very sweet. And then the dog got up and started doing other things. But and I also remember the picture of that dog when I was a little puppy, and it's really big now because it's a golden retriever. So another one, I visualize the Dalai Lama and imagine he's looking right at me, caring about me, including me in his heart. I curl up with my dog, or if she isn't around, imagine how excited she is every time I get home and how she sleeps pressed against my legs. I say, please love me. And imagine the trees and birds, the flowers, rocks, and all creatures sending me love. I imagine my future self, totally fearless, welcoming, warm, compassionate, and ask him for help. I call on Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, or Avalokiteshvara, and visualize a radiance surrounding me and imagine it entering and filling me with her mercy and kindness. I ask my partner to hold me, and if she isn't there, imagine her arms around me. I wear a bracelet, a beaded lapis mala, and when I take it off and feel each bead carefully, there's a link to Buddha nature, to compassion, to presence. I softly recite a short Jewish prayer my grandfather taught me, and it reminds me of his loving heart and of the love in the universe. I lie down on the earth or lean against a large old oak tree behind our home. I let my sorrows be held by the vastness of the earth and sky. And if I'm in my windowless cubicle 12 stories up, I imagine all of that. I put my hand on my heart and repeat phrases of loving kindness for myself and others. May I be happy. free from danger, at peace. May you be happy, free from danger, at peace. I remember other people I know who are suffering as I am. Feel us as a community of beings, the shared humanness of it. So I read these and I think, oh, this is the pure land itself is near. This is the energy field of a Buddha. So it's possible for us to access it really so easily. I mean, those are very simple things. Hakuin says, if we hear this truth even once, so this truth that the Pure Land itself is near, if we hear this truth even once and listen with a grateful heart, treasuring it, revering it, we gain blessings without end. But sometimes we can't hear it. Sometimes we're so afraid or undernurtured, we can't hear the truth that the Pure Land is near. In this case, Tara suggests how to access nurturing when the fear is strong. So her recommendations is, doesn't sound surprising, the first thing, guide our attention to our body and breath. And then identify a resource anchor, so that some of the anchors that I mentioned, or it also could just be a word, it could be simplified into one word, maybe grandmother, or bird song, or the earth. Maybe it's an object, like the mala beads, or it could be a gesture, like the placing the hand on the heart. And then another really important thing is she talks about building positive states into long-lasting positive traits. And I'll say a little bit about what that means. So states are something that, you know, a state of mind, a state of being can kind of come and go. But a trait is something that's a little more long-lasting. You know, it's like it's a pattern. It's an automatic thing that it's there. It's a characteristic. It's part of you. So one thing that's true that we know about how our brains work is that because our brains are geared for survival, we tend to remember the negative things more quickly and easily, because it's like we need to. We need to, in order to survive, we need to know what's dangerous, what's poisonous, you know, what's harmful, so that we can avoid it in the future and live. So our brains are wired in that way. If something negative comes, like, we actually see it much more quickly and it goes into our long-term memory much more quickly. When a positive state comes, like, oh, that's a nice smell, or that's a good feeling in my body, you know, our survival brain doesn't need to hang on to that. So one thing that psychology has shown is that it takes longer, like maybe 10 seconds or something, for that to actually, 25. Oh, 25 seconds. Okay, longer than 10 seconds. The negative is like 1 second, it's right there. But the positive, you know, it's almost half a minute. So then we have to really work at remembering the positive. So this is where taking the time to pull those things in and remember, which sometimes, you know, we can think, and maybe not so many of you, but people who are sort of hardcore Zen practitioners are like, oh, that's just mushy stuff. I want to be enlightened. I'm going to sit still and upright with energy and vigor. And like, oh, that's great, but to keep doing that in a way that's sustainable for the long term, we actually really need to pay attention to the nurturing in our body and the positive, and cultivate the positive states into longer lasting things. So I want to do a little bit of a reflection from Tara on remembering the positive. So So if you just, if you want to kind of get yourself settled a little bit, you know, you might, so a lot of times before doing a reflection or a meditation, I always like to move my body a little, stretch a little, so that then I can remember to be relaxed and settle down. So first, getting in touch just with our breath and our body. So breathing in, knowing we're breathing in. Breathing out, knowing we're breathing out. Breathing in, aware of our whole body. Breathing out, aware of our whole body. And then bringing to mind something positive that happened lately to you, or a positive feeling that you had. So this could be a moment where you felt calm, confident, you felt love, you felt safe. But really try to imagine and just take time to pick something. Even something really, could be something really simple, like the taste of the tea that I had this morning. A kind word that someone said to you. Even a nice memory that you had. And really, as much as possible, re-enter into that experience. So what is going on in your body as you reflect on that experience? And not even necessarily answering that question with words of what is going on in your body, but just touching or re-experiencing what is happening in your body as you think of this positive experience that you had. And as you breathe and be with this positive experience, as much as possible, staying with it. So breathing and just staying with it. Even if the experience itself was only a second or two, let's try to stay with it for 15 to 30 seconds. And if the positive experience from the past is now morphing into a positive experience now, that's fine. You can just let that evolve and let yourself feel that. So just allowing this positive sense to fill your body, and inviting it to become as big as it can be. And involving all of your senses in this experience. So what are you seeing and hearing, either in your mind's eye or right now? How is your body experiencing touch? temperature, energy, movement. Is taste or smell part of the experience? Intend that the experience sink into your cells, the way light fills a room or water soaks into a sponge. Sense that you are letting in the felt experience, surrendering to it, receiving it into yourself. And now take a few moments to reflect on what feels meaningful or significant about the experience. So here, words or stories might come back in, and that's okay. And it's also okay if they don't. So we'll close that reflection now, but of course you can return to it anytime, even while I'm talking, if you want to return to your feeling, your positive experience. So Tara says the key to the successful installation, so making this positive into more of a trait, is repetition. So accessing and installing over and over. And she suggests practicing when you're feeling fine. So you could practice like that when you notice something positive, like that kind word or that sip of tea or the sound of the birds or the sun on your face, whatever it is. You could just take, 30 seconds or more, but maybe you don't have more than 30 seconds. But if you even have 30 seconds to just install it. But she says you could also do it when you're feeling grumpy or a bit stressed. You could say, oh, let me remember, what are my resource anchors? And then and then call to mind a positive that you can, so you can practice. And it's not like rejecting the grumpiness. So there's a, sometimes it is important, well, with the rain practice, recognize I'm grumpy. But like sometimes before you go there, you might need to first do the your positive resource anchor. Like, okay, now that I have the positive resource anchor, okay, now I'm recognized I'm grumpy and allow it to be there. But it's from this base then of a positive trait. So that can be really helpful. How's everybody doing so far? And if you're doing so-so, you could do this, or if you're doing that, you could do that. So Hakuin says, much more, so he says first. Let me go back and just read the whole thing again. The pure land itself is near. Those who hear this truth even once and listen with a grateful heart, treasuring it, revering it, gain blessings without end. So I think this treasuring it, revering it is like this calling to mind, this installing the positive. So those who do that, then he says, much more, if you turn yourself about and confirm your own self nature. And there was actually a typo in the thing I sent out. It says in your thing, that self nature that is no nature, which it's okay, but I think the should be the self nature that is no nature. Probably in the original, there wasn't an article anyway, because often there's not in Japanese. So I'm just, for now, I'm just going to use the. He says, much more, if you turn yourself about and confirm your own self nature, the self nature that is no nature, you shall go far beyond self-deceptive arguments. So turn yourself about, like the hokey pokey. Tara talks about the path out of trance is making a U-turn. That's what it's all about. Making a U-turn. When we're in a trance, we shift our attention from the stories about what's going on to the real living experience in our body. Not that the stories aren't important, but that we don't get swept away by them. So that's really, it's like an instruction for Zazen. Don't get swept away by the stories. So I feel like I'm kind of repeating, but that's okay because maybe that's how we learn. I think this is like her Zazen instruction, which she talks about. It's the U-turn, but to me it's really like the turn the light to shine within, then just return from Dogen. Begin by pausing, sitting comfortably, allowing your eyes to close or be gently open. Take a few deep breaths. With each exhale, let go of any obvious tension in your mind and body. Now, shift your attention fully away from any remaining stories or thoughts and notice your actual present moment experience. What sensations are in your body? Are there strong emotions present? Do you feel anxious or restless as you try to step out of your mental stories? Do you feel pulled to resume your activities? So often it's like that, and I think it's maybe especially hard during a Zoom retreat at home, because it's like we're sitting here and then it's like, oh, that's right, I've got to, you know, put a load of laundry in or whatever. You know, we have something that we're, you know, and maybe we do have to do something. So I'm not judging you if you get up, but just to notice internally, like, do I really need to get up or is it restlessness? And can I simply stay right here for these few moments or this 30 minutes or 35 minutes and just be with whatever is unfolding inside of me? So that's kind of her Zazen instruction, I think. She calls it making a U-turn. So when we do this, when we make the U-turn away from the stories and thoughts into the felt experience in the body, the actual moment-to-moment experience, I think this is the true self. So this is our own self nature beyond our stories and our egos. So sometimes in psychology, there's talk about the true self and the false self. And the false self is like what others put on you, you know, and, you know, what you feel like you have to live up to, whereas the true self is what, you know, is like internally, what your own heart. So this is related to that, but it's a little bit larger than that, because this true self is like the true self that actually isn't even like my own heart, but it's the heart, it's everyone's heart, but it's not like heart from my mom, her idea, or from my boss, their idea, or, you know, from like whatever, yeah, my teacher, or from like what I think it means to be a woman or a man or a person, you know, even that, like what, you know, that is like an overlay of something. And this true self is beyond that, beyond all those ideas. So that's what Hawkwind is talking about when he says the self nature that is no nature. It means self nature that's not limited to one thing. So we're not limited to our stories about who we are. The stories are important, but they're not the only thing. So he says, when we do that, when we turn ourselves about, make the U-turn, confirm our own self nature, the self nature that is no nature, it says, you shall go far beyond self-deceptive arguments. So that's my slant on the translation from Zenki Shibayama, who is one of the translators. You know, I kind of cobbled together different translators for the version that we're reading. So his translation, the line actually was, you will have gone beyond the ken of sophistry. And I thought, well, that, you know, I had to look up what that meant. So I thought, you know, I mean, probably there's people who are smarter than me that didn't need to look it up and it would have been fine, but I changed it. But actually, so ken means one's range of knowledge, our own range of knowledge. And sophistry means the use of fallacious arguments, especially with the intention of deceiving. So when I put those two together, I kind of got, oh, that's like the self-deceptive arguments. Like we're deceiving ourselves about who we really are. And so if we instead turn ourselves about, confirm our own self nature, the self nature that is no nature, then we go beyond that. We're not stuck in our ideas about who we are and what we are. Oh, so another translation, which I wasn't able to find who the translator was. I just found it online, but it says, we will go beyond ego and past clever words. So that's also pretty good. So all of this is to say that even the Dharma could be used to bolster up the ego. And we can talk on and on about Buddhist teachings, but still be in a trance. So in this way, if we do that, we deceive ourselves about our own understanding. But if we make the U-turn, we go beyond that and we wake up to presence. So another, I just want to close with touching on another Pure Land teaching, which I think relates to what's going on with us and especially what Anita brought up yesterday. So another Pure Land teaching is that after spending time in the Pure Land or presence or fully nurtured state, we can return to the six worlds as a bodhisattva. So the suffering beings are in the six worlds or the six realms. So that's what that reference is to the six realms. So remember earlier in Hakuin's Song of Zazen, he says, lost on dark paths of ignorance, we wander through the six worlds. So the six worlds, six realms are, there's animal realm, hell realm, hungry ghost, fighting gods, celestial realm, and human realm. And they're all considered realms of suffering. So I'll just say, like, I think the animal realm is misnamed because it sort of disparages animals. So but I think maybe a better name for that is like the mere survival realm. So when we think about when we're in this realm, it's like all we can do to just, you know, get through and live. And so a lot of times, you know, people who are oppressed are in this realm, this mere survival realm. So like I think about, especially now, the young black men and women who are really under threat from white supremacists, from police, from systems of oppression, you know, and it's like mere survival. Like, how can I not be shot when I'm, you know, stopped because my tail light is broken? You know, like that. So so we can see maybe clearly how that's suffering or the hell realm is suffering. I'm not going to talk, I could talk a lot about all these, but just say even the celestial realm or the heavenly realm is suffering because beings in this realm have no compassion. So it's not the Pure Land. it's really a trance state of disconnect, disconnect with the body. And so actually people who are very, very extremely wealthy might be in this realm, because it's harder to connect, because there's so many creature comforts are taken care of that it's actually harder to connect and have compassion. So anyway, all of these realms are suffering, and the idea is that a person who, after they've been nurtured in the pure land, or, you know, received the nurturing step in rain, they can enter the six worlds and help beings. So with this in mind, I was thinking about the person or persons who killed the raccoon and nailed it to a telephone pole near Anita's Black Lives Matter sign. So this is really someone probably in a hell realm. That hell realm is filled with anger and hatred, or perhaps a fighting God realm. Maybe anger and hatred, isn't it? Maybe it's the vying for control, jealous, vengeful, trying to maintain one's position, like in this case of white superiority. So a lot of times people who are in that, especially that fighting God realm, don't know their suffering. They don't see their suffering. They're not touching their suffering. And then, like I said, too, then the young Black men and women who are in this realm of mere survival, thwarted at every turn, there's danger everywhere, how to just get by. So how can we, as bodhisattvas, what can we do with regard to beings in these realms? So I think that Anita and her family putting up a Black Lives Matter sign is something that it probably seemed like a small bodhisattva gesture, but now it turned into a big thing. Because doing that, putting up that sign and staying with it, and not to say you have to stay with it, Anita, but because, you know, of course we need to all, like, what is the best way to go forward for the long term? But putting up that sign, staying with it, or staying with the energy around supporting Black lives, it says to the young men and women, you are struggling to get by and we are here with you. So that is really important. And then I think about, well, what about the suffering of the perpetrators? And it's actually much, much more difficult to be a bodhisattva in the hell realm or the jealous God realm. It might seem impossible. But if we're really interested in dismantling white supremacy and internalized racism, I don't think we can do that if we only just surround ourselves with people who agree with us. So what can we do? As a Black friend of mine asked me, what do you say to your white friends who don't get it? And he was asking this for him too, because he had a white friend who didn't get it. So he was like, what do you say? And we talked, it was like, it's hard what you say. So I loved, I found this article, well, I've seen it before, but I looked at this article by Ayoya Tunde, some of you know her, called Buddhism in the Age of Black Lives Matter. And she gave these suggestions for what we can do when, she says, when Black Lives Matter activists are being attacked, but you could say when anyone who is, you know, standing up for others is being attacked. And she references what the Buddha taught about it. She said, if you're slandered, question the veracity of the slanderer without the intention to harm them, and tell the truth without attempting to force others to accept your truth. So we're not really trying to change their minds, but we're also not being silent. Then she says, if you're physically attacked, tell the attacker to stop. Renounce any intention to hurt the attacker. So there's these two things. You tell the attacker to stop, then you renounce any intention on your part to hurt the attacker. And then protect yourself. So again, it's like not about just whatever. Protect yourself. And then here's the part that could be a turning point. Remind your attacker of the goodness within them in order to help them transform their ignorance, anxiety, and aggression. So if there's a way that a turning word could be said or a turning gesture, if it comes from an intention of protecting myself, so standing up, taking care of myself, telling you to stop if you're hurting me, speaking my truth, not making you believe me, not making that necessary. And then if I can see something of goodness in that person and remind them that it's there. And so sometimes like that is like so hard, like, oh, I can't see it. I actually can't see it. So then if we can't see it, maybe better not to engage. But I did think this was really helpful, that we could plant that seed as an intention going forward. It does sound like a pretty tall order though. I think that just comes back to why it's so important to have that nurture step in order to be a bodhisattva and to keep going back to that. We really need to have a taste of that pure land right here in order to enter the six worlds of suffering and effect transformation. So I talked a lot today. I'll close with that. And I just also want to say thank you to all of you bodhisattva warriors, wherever you are on that journey. Deep gratitude.